This is Track and Field History with Jesse Squire. I'm producer Chris Chavez with a brief introduction for this episode. In this show, you'll hear Jesse sit down with Ken Go, who was a sports writer for the Oregonian for 43 years and just announced his retirement a couple weeks ago. He's got deep ties covering track and field since he was assigned the beat as he first got his start at the paper. He takes us through those early days in his career and the evolution he's seen in the sport ever since. That, plus some thoughts on the state of the sport's future and his very honest opinion. Be sure to subscribe and leave a nice review for the Track and Field History Podcast on the City of Smack Podcast Network. Without further ado, enjoy the rest of this episode.
Are you enjoying not having to do the daily grind anymore?
Yes, though I'm still getting used to it. It is nice to get up and spend time with the New York Times rather than trying to rush through it till I can get to work.
How long had you been working as a sports writer, and where did you start?
I've been at the Oregonian for 43 years. Prior to that, I worked for 1 year at a weekly in Woodburn, Oregon, which is about 30 miles south of Portland. And before that, I was in college. So pretty much my whole career at the Oregonian.
Oh, wow. Okay. When did they first put you on, start having you cover track and field?
Well, I did it sort of by fits and starts. When I started at the Oregonian, I was a high school writer, so I covered some high school track then. And then I sort of moved on and covered college football and basketball for several years. And in 1988, they told me they wanted me to cover college track, and I resisted. There's a lot of specialized knowledge in track, and I didn't feel prepared. It's not a sport that I participated in, nor one I'd really spent much time watching when I wasn't covering a meet. But they made me do it anyway. And for several years there, I covered the University of Oregon's track team. At that point, the Ducks were declining nationally. The men's team under Bill Dellinger was trying very hard to still be a relevant dual meet team in an era when few other teams were doing the dual meet thing. And to try to cover all the events, he sliced and diced scholarships. And so they were a very competitive dual meet team, except nobody was doing dual meets. They had one against the Washington State every year. But really, the sport had moved on. He hadn't. And so they were not relevant at the national level. And we stopped covering them. The women's team also had declined a little bit. Tom Heinen, the longtime women's coach, very successful. But for whatever reason, his teams the last few years did not succeed nationally. So we stopped covering the Oregon men's track team at that point regularly. We had a writer that would cover stories, feature stories, but there were no real meets to speak of after Dellinger left. They brought in Martin Smith, who was much more in tune with what the prevalent philosophy was in the NCAA, but the downside to that was there were very few meets at Hayward Field because he was always dividing up his athletes to go to wherever the competition was best, which is how you got relevant nationally. So we basically stopped covering them. And then towards the end of the Martin Smith era, a certain gentleman in Beaverton who had run track at Oregon and was quite wealthy was not happy with the direction of the program. And so he wanted to do two things. He wanted to bring back the excitement of track and field to Eugene. And he wanted that by, he wanted to do that by making the University of Oregon a relevant team, both during the regular season and in the postseason. And he wanted to bring meets back. And so he went out and hired, he put up the money, and it was his impetus. The university went out and hired Vin Lanana, who was very good at doing both of those things. He made the team relevant on a meet-by-meet basis. They had as many as five home meets a season when he was running things. And they were competitive nationally again. And he brought the big meets back. It was under Lanana's direction that Eugene got the 2008, 2012, 2016 Olympic trials, and will have the Olympic trials again whenever they're held, whether it's this year or whatever that is. So at that time, when he came back in, track became a bigger story. So they put me back on it as a regular beat. And at about that same time, with Nike's investment, some very strong elite professional teams sprang up in Portland and in Eugene, so that sport became relevant, not just collegiately, but professionally. So that's probably a very long-winded answer to your question, but that's sort of what happened.
Well, 43 years is a little bit of a long time, so you may have given it short shrift right there, actually. But I, like so many people, I followed you on Twitter, and that's how I got to know your work and your writing. And I think I got on Twitter, somewhere around 2008 to 2010 or 11, and there really weren't that many people that did track and field or really much of anything else on Twitter. So you gravitated to what was there. And so to me, it seemed like you had always been doing this, but it turns out that you had returned to track and field pretty much just a little bit before that. Because I think the transition to Lenana and reemphasizing track and field at Oregon started somewhere around, I don't remember when Lenana was hired, but somewhere around 2005 or 2006, because he had been coach at Dartmouth and then was over at Stanford and had done the same thing at Stanford. He had brought in a lot of big meets and a lot more home meets and emphasized things and raised the level of the team. It's amazing to think that Stanford hadn't beaten Cal in a dual meet, in their annual dual meet, for something like 15 or 20 years until Lenato was there. And then at one point, he just up and said, I'm done with this. I don't want to do this anymore. And became the athletic director at Oberlin College, which, if you want to talk about the least stressful job in college athletics in America, that's probably it. Because that's probably the only place that has a full athletic program but emphasizes it less might be Caltech. I mean, really. I mean, the football team averages a win every two or three years. But then he came back in, and it's real actual work to not only have a good team, but to try to make it interesting and something people want to follow. So kind of is just thinking around ideas in my head, what I wanted to ask you about in the time that you've been covering track and field. You know, things change in every sport. What do you see as positive changes, and what do you see as some negative changes?
Well, we'll start positive. I think in the time I've been covering track, American distance running has come back. It was basically irrelevant internationally prior to that point. There were occasional good individuals, but nobody that I can think of who really challenged the world at the elite level for some time. And that's come back. The United States is relevant in most events now, from the 800 meters to the marathon, both men and women. And again, I give a lot of credit to Vin Lenana and the people at Nike who backed him, but they brought the World Junior Championships to Eugene. They brought the World Indoor Championships to Portland. And at some point, maybe there'll be a World Outdoor Championships in Eugene. Phil Knight himself has invested in a track stadium in Eugene. It's probably certainly the best in North America, and maybe one of the best in the world. I've not seen the inside of it, but based on what I can tell and what I hear, that's the case. I think those are all positive developments. Negative developments, I see the sport is becoming less and less relevant to the average American sports fan. At one time in the 1950s and 60s, it was a major sport. People really cared about track, not just at the Olympics. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I think a lot of the things that, when I talked about what Bill Dellinger was trying to do with the track team, what he wanted to do with, and I didn't understand it at the time, he wanted to keep track relevant to the average sports fan. And the average sports fan doesn't really care about what somebody's personal best is, or if somebody moved up from seventh to fifth on the career 1500 meter list. In my view, what the average sports fan wants to do is see my team beat your team. And college track has gotten away from that. There are very few dual meets anymore. And as a consequence, I don't think people who aren't invested in the sport pay any attention to it. And I think the ultimate result of this is you see now with the pandemic cutting college athletic budgets, where the places that athletic departments choose to cut are places that don't have any outside emotional investment, and fans and boosters don't care about college track. They rarely go. I'm sure they're happy if their college track team is successful, but they're not at the meets and they don't know who the athletes are on the teams. And all their emotional investment in their athletic department is in football and basketball. And once in a while, in some places, maybe baseball or, you know, rowing. Or at Oregon, at University of Oregon, it's still track, but they're an outlier. So you see college track teams being cut now, men's track especially, and you see people wringing their I agree. I think it's a shame. I think track's a great sport, but I understand it too. I mean, it's a revenue drain on the athletic department, and they don't have any people outside the sport who are going to speak up for it. So, sorry, long-winded again.
Yeah, it's hard to find a non-revenue sport with a larger scholarship budget, with a larger roster, and that's even now with roster restrictions. I was on a college track team that had 70 men on it. I mean, we weren't great, but we definitely could fill every event. We had no trouble filling every event. And then the equipment cost and the travel costs are extremely high as well. I think track and field's biggest problem on every level, past high school. In high school, we don't have this problem, but once you get to college and beyond, I think track and field's biggest problem is that our athletes compete less often than athletes in virtually any sport save boxing and horse racing. And those are probably the only two sports that have had a bigger drop in popularity than track and field. And I just worked at a cross country meet yesterday. We had the Mid-American Conference. It was the first conference to really cut everything this fall. And then when everybody else didn't, they changed the mind. And we had our conference cross country championships yesterday. Well, nobody cares how fast you're running cross country because the course, the weather, it's kind of like, you know, you're what you shoot in golf. To an average Joe, it matters. But, you know, a pro or even a collegian knows the difference between a 5-under and a 10-under has more to do with the weather and the course than anything else, you know. So you know, in my mind, college cross country is actually more interesting these days than college track is, because it is really does come down to, does my team beat your team? Both, you know, in just every competition is scored, but also, you know, when you're kind of looking around, well, are we going to make, it's kind of like looking at the bubble for college basketball. You know, you look at who you beat and who you haven't beaten and who's in and who's not. And that's really what it all comes down to. And I'd love for something like that to happen with track and field. But the problem is that, you know, there's, I think as much as anything, it's a culture change. Yes, there's a change in the 1970s, there were colleges that had, you know, 20 some scholarships for men's track and field. And nobody does anymore. But there were very few universities that had that. Where I went to school had 6, and they were still NCAA indoor runner-up, 1 point out of the championship, and they ran full dual meets. It's just a change in culture and an expectation of how you do things. To talk about how things have changed in Oregon, in your part of the country. Now, it was not something that you covered professionally before you started working at the Oregonian, but was it something that, just as someone who is a sports fan or someone peripherally involved in sports media in high school and college, was it something of some importance in the Pacific Northwest in the early 80s maybe even late 70s?
Yeah, I would say so. Late 70s and early 80s, Oregon was still relevant. Dellinger and Heinen's teams were nationally successful. I'm trying to remember the last Oregon men's title, I believe it was mid-80s, Bill Dellinger team. And Heinonen won the NCAA or whatever it was. It might have been the AIAW at that point, but he won a national championship in the late 70s or early 80s. Yeah, they were still relevant. The UCLA dual meet was a big deal. Washington State dual meet was a big deal. Washington dual meet was a big deal. But those schools stopped wanting to come to Eugene for dual meets. John Chaplin, who had been the coach at Washington State, and he and Dellinger had a nice little rivalry that went on for years. And Chaplin was a showman, so he made the most of it. He was always fun because he always made a point of he would not speak publicly to anyone on the Oregon side of the Columbia River. So he would come down and he wouldn't talk to anybody. And it was sort of a game. And one of the first NCAA meets, I believe it was NCAA meet, I covered, he was still at Washington State and they were in the running. He was again honoring his pledge not to talk to anybody at the national championships, which, you know, wasn't necessarily going to work. So the Washington State SID would go get an interview on her tape recorder, and then she'd bring it out. And here was Chaplin's communique for the day. No, they made it fun. But yeah, that all went away. I mean, Chaplin left, and the people that followed him weren't that interested in having dual meets. And really the only person left who really wanted to have dual meets was Bill Dellinger.
Yeah, it's and there were characters too, you know. I mean, the way that Woody Hayes acted on the football field and off the football field is intolerable today. But at the same time, boy, the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry is a huge rivalry right where I live. And I don't think it would be what it was if it weren't for Woody and Bo going back and forth and back and forth. And it, and
if Urban had stayed, if Urban and Harbaugh might have gotten it going there.
Yes. Oh, sure. But neither one of them is quite the personality of Woody and Bo, which became bigger than anything. Yeah. Side story. There's a little like Chautauqua, which is, I don't know if anybody even knows what that is, but it's like a little tiny summertime religious community, like all cottages there.
You got Chautauqua grounds here.
Yeah, and it's a Methodist place, which means they do not sell alcohol in the whole town. But they have what they call a sports restaurant. It's like a sports pub, but you can tell everything you need to know about where you are. You're in Ohio because there's two pictures on the wall, Jesus and Woody Hayes, and they're both the same height. So, but we don't have the only personality quite like that in coaching these days is banned currently. He's Salazar. You can say a lot of things about him, both good and bad, but you can always say he rarely was not entertaining. USA Indoors. I just found myself standing about 10 feet away from him a few years ago. And it was the most intense look I had ever seen on someone's face. And they often say that football coaches are high-functioning lunatics. And he kind of fit the mold, you know, that he was a high-functioning lunatic, or at least appeared to be right at that moment. The thing that struck me, you know, as someone from way across the country, looking at Eugene and the Pacific Northwest, but Eugene specifically, was that back in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, it was sort of like this sort of like enclave, this weird place tucked away in the woods where people cared about distance running. When even when we had some good distance runners like Bill Rogers and Frank Shorter and some others, and Steve Prefontaine, still cared. Nobody cared about distance running. Yeah. Took longer than 2 minutes to run, we didn't care. Even the mile was considered a long distance. Well, then it just kind of stayed this little enclave in the woods. And then when people tried to bring some interest to track and field again, they brought the trials to Eugene and brought other meets to Eugene. And now this little tucked away place in the woods is the only place that remains. It's like the magic forest to me. Where the magic has left everywhere else, but it's still living in this one place. And the problem then is that it's the only place. It's hard to grow it from there because it's a very different town than most other places in America.
Yeah, I think that's true.
You know, now you don't have to go to anything, but do we have any idea what's going to be happening with the Pac-12 as far as any kind of sports this winter or spring? I know I've been asked to announce a couple of indoor meets, and I've just said, I really don't think I can do that. If you can get by without me, I'm just going to take a pass. So we don't even have any idea of what's happening this spring, even with outdoor sports. It seems like whereas now we'd be looking, we'd already have some schedules in any other year. Yeah. Now it seems like it's an eon away. Have you heard anything about any concrete plans to actually try to get the World Outdoor Championships done in Eugene?
Well, I think there's hope by 2022 that we'll be on the other side of the pandemic and that will happen. But I think a lot of what happens in 2022 is going to depend on what happens the time leading up to that. And I think we still don't know for sure. I see hopeful signs about vaccines that are 90 and 95% effective, which is great. But they haven't been approved yet, one. And two, they haven't been manufactured yet. And three, they have to be distributed. And to me, all those are major hurdles. And whether all that can get done by this spring, I think I think that's a reach. I'd like to see it happen. Hopefully, I'm tired of quarantining in my house. I'd like to go out to dinner occasionally. My wife and I, I retired. We'd like to travel. So, I mean, all those things are things that it's hard to do regularly until we're on the other side of the pandemic. And, we're not there yet. And whatever we thought we knew about the pandemic a month ago is different. So I don't see how that's going to change next month or the month after that. I have serious doubts whether College Track is going to be able to pull off an indoor season. I think outdoors got a better shot. I think the virus doesn't spread as easily outdoors. Track is one sport where for the most part you can distance.
It's much easier to spread out at an outdoor track meet than an indoor
right.
one.
And, right. So yeah, I think that there's a chance at an outdoor season. But I wouldn't put any money on there being a college indoor season.
Yeah. That's one of the other things that I think has really changed over the time that since you started at the Oregonian. For all the championships that Steve Prefontaine won, he never ran at the NCAA indoor. Places where it doesn't snow in the winter very much, they really didn't care about indoor track. UCLA never went to NCAA indoors until the mid-90s, I don't think. They always had a home dual meet the same day as the NCAA indoor. And I think that's one of the things is now we're trying to have hold everybody the same standard and try to shoehorn a gigantic country into one mold. It seems to me that it's insane to ask teams in New England to try to run an outdoor season in April. At the same time, it's insane to ask teams in, say, Southern California to fly out to indoor meets in February. It's merely one of those administrative things where everybody has to be exactly the same. And when you sit back and look at it, it makes no sense.
Pac-12 does not sponsor indoor track. So the Pac-12 teams have to belong to the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation, I think it is.
Yeah. But even so, I see, the one year that I went out to the USA indoors, they're finishing up the Mountain West Conference the day before. I sat and watched San Diego State win the women's meet. And I'm thinking, why is San Diego State running indoors in February? Isn't that why everybody goes to San Diego in February? So what we're going through is rough, but you can always get something good out of something. What do you think that track and field may be able to get good, improve itself, or get something positive out of this huge negative that's affected the entire world?
Yeah, well, I think actually something pretty cool happened this summer. when athletes, for the most part, U.S. athletes weren't traveling to compete in track. And what happened, I think sort of organically, was regional meets sprung up where local organizers found ways to comply with their area's coronavirus regulations and actually have meets. Portland Track, which is organization that puts on several track meets over the course of the year, and two elite meets, the Portland Track Festival and the Stumptown Twilight, had to cancel both of those, but instead put on a series of meets they called the Big Friendlies, which had they were basically distance meets, matching athletes from the local running clubs. Pete Julian's Nike Group participated, OTC Elite, Oregon Track Club Elite participated, the Brooks Beasts participated, the Wazelle Little Wing group participated, and they actually kept standings and had a team that won at the end of the year. And it was like a sort of a grassroots thing again, where not only were they able to compete, but they were competing as teams, which I think is a big step in the right direction. I think there were similar things happening in Atlanta, in Michigan, and in Southern California. And to me, that's where track needs to be going. You need to have these teams competing against each other in team competitions where it doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's cool if somebody runs a 145, 800 meters, but what's more cool is if your team goes 1-2-3 in the 800 and clinches the meet. To me, that's how the sport's going to resonate again with the general public.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, because I'm busy with track, I pay almost zero attention to college basketball. But when the tournament comes around, I'm really looking at team names. I don't know who any of the stars are. I just know that I'm going to cheer for the teams from the Mid-American Conference, Michigan, Ohio State, and I'm going to hate Duke. That's what everybody does, right? And you learn the athletes. You don't have to know the athletes, and that's same kind of thing. At the meet yesterday, it was that there were some students that showed up, and it was basically, we care about the team in orange and we hate the team in blue, and that's really what it comes down to. But in track and field, you have to have sort of like this mental checklist almost of like, well, who's the best in these different events. And that's also one of the things that changed from the 1950s and 60s till now. There were men only competition and maybe 12 or 15 events that we really did in the United States. We didn't do the hammer throw or the triple jump or steeplechase or the long distance. Basically, we went up to the 2 mile. Knowing who the best sprinters, middle distance runners and jumpers and throwers were was not that hard a thing to do. But now you're talking about 40 events, and it's much more complicated.
Well, I think one thing Lanana did when he was here, and what the Prefontaine Classic has done, which is the Diamond League meet that is here professionally, don't try to do every event. Let's have a nice tight window of time, so we're not asking people to come spend all day at the track. Let's pick some events that are going to be fun to watch, and let's have those. I mean, there's no reason you got to run every event at every meet.
No. And the one college meet, we used to have a pro indoor circuit. That's completely fallen apart. But the one indoor meet in my part of the country that for a long time actually did have a big fan turnout was the Mayo Invitational at Notre Dame. And Joe Piani, who was the head coach for a long time, it wasn't all day meet. They did have events going all day, but the A heats of the most important events, including the Mayo Mile, where they gave people boomsticks, whatever else, invite them out on the track, and you got this huge corridor for people to run through. It was just 2 hour block of time. If you're going to come watch meet, this is when to show up, and this is when it's going to be over. I think what happens is we end up having sports run by track fans who love things like the Penn Relays, so we could sit there all day. Yeah, but most people don't have all day. You know, we just don't. That's the most popular sport in the world is soccer, because it takes 2 hours of your time one day a week. You know who wins or loses. Sometimes it's a draw. But again, it comes down to, are they wearing my colors? That's all it comes down to.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time. We're up to, we've been talking for half an hour, it looks like now.
Yeah, it went fast.
Yeah, and it really was one of my highlights of going to the last Olympic trials, when I finally got to meet you in person at the nice little thing they had for the media after hours out there. I'm always more fascinated to talk to the writers, because we have to make sense out of what we see. The athletes just go out and do it. So
it was a treat for me too, because I followed you as a fan. I'm a big fan of your writing. I know it's not your main career, but you do it very well, and you always have a take, which I appreciate, opinion. And it, your opinion, whether I agreed with it or not, I always logically could follow how you got there. So,
well, thank you very much. So,
yeah, no, anytime. It'd be always fun.